Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey.
Welcome to this week's episode of The Movie Log. This week, we travel back in time to the foggy streets of 1880s Edinburgh in this week's movie, the 1945 horror film, The Body Snatcher. Not to be confused with the 1956 film Invasion of the Body Snatchers, or the 1978 remake, or the R-rated horror film The Body Snatchers, again, having nothing to do with this week's episode, or, quite frankly, none of the novels that use similar titles. This film was directed by Robert Wise. It stars Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi, Henry Daniell, and Edith Atwater, based on the short story The Body Snatcher by Robert Louis Stevenson. Produced by Val Lewton, this week's Hollywood monster is the serial killer.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right, Izzy, why did you pick this film?
Well, I picked this movie because, when you start a conversation about the history of horror and films, you can't leave out Boris Karloff or Bela Lugosi. And they're so tied into Universal Studios and their Hollywood monsters, which we've talked many times on here about how much I love Universal monsters. But there's so much awesomeness that they perform outside of Universal's that contribute to the history of horror, which is one of the reasons why I picked this movie.
Because this movie was produced by RKO in 45, right?
Yes, which is another... RKO is another studio that opens a section of the studio dedicated to horror movies that a lot more opportunities for audiences to see horror, especially since they focus on B-horror films.
And they also used it as a way to groom editors, directors, screenwriters for their studio. And that's where this film was directed by Robert Wise. It's like his third or fourth film.
This is his first like director film that he gets like full credit for, because there is evidence that he took over for the director of Cat People.
Or The Black Cat.
No, it's Cat People. Okay. Because the director ran out of money, went over budget, didn't stick to the schedule, so they kicked him out and he finished the film. So he didn't get credit for that film. But this is like the first movie where he is
getting credit,
and it's his vision.
And there's also the story that he was the editor on Citizen Kane. He was also editing The Magnificent Ambersons, which was Orson Welles' follow-up to Citizen Kane,
which were produced by RKO.
And they were having they had problems and reshoots on The Magnificent Ambersons, and Robert Wise was the person who directed those, again getting no credit. So this is like his third movie, I think, that he gets, and then his first he gets full credit for.
And the mention of Orson Welles is very important in his directing history, because you can see, especially with his early work, Robert Wise, the influence that working with Orson Welles as his editor and as his reshooter influenced his camera work.
And also working with Greg Toland, because Greg Toland is the person who shot Citizen Kane. And he works in editing of the film with that Citizen Kane. He saw Greg Toland's use of light, dark, shooting it in black and white, how he would frame shots with black or with light. And Greg Toland, of course, did this through the 30s because of film noir.
Mm-hmm. Which is also another thing that RKO
was really famous for.
Yes.
So great. Yeah. So having worked with two of the two really good and talented people and edited for them, definitely you can see the influence in this film about the way that where he places the camera. He's obviously working with the cinematographer to change levels, and the way that it's lit, it's much moodier than, so it is one of those horror films that's really moody versus ultimately super scary.
Which is what Val Lewton, which was the producer, was known for, were these moody atmospheric horrors instead of like bloody horrors or violent horrors or things like that.
Yeah. And that's so, when you think of this film and you're thinking of Robert Wise, and you think later on, he's going to go move on and start directing some of the most famous musicals ever directed. It's kind of funny when you watch these first couple of films and how he's working on these horror films. Mm-hmm.
Just so if people aren't aware, he did West Side Story, the 1961 version with Natalie Wood, and then he also did Sound of Music in 1965.
Yes. He also directed, a lot of people who, if you're a Star Trek nerd, he also, at the end of his career, directed Star Trek the Motion Picture. And it's kind of ironic that he was, at the first part of his career, he was somebody they brought in to help finish a movie, and Star Trek the Motion Picture was a movie that he was never allowed to finish the way that he wanted to finish it.
Yeah, it's kind of a full circle.
Yeah, because, and the years later, Paramount did do a thing with him before he passed away, where they brought him in and he was able to re-edit it, and they CGI'd the special effects that he wanted in the film. And I have to say, after watching that version, I know we're going on a little Trekkie here thing, but watching that version, it was a much better film. And a lot of people tend to point to this as he was at the top of his game. And so it wasn't like you could point to this as being really a Robert Wise film. But when you watch his final edit, it's a much better film. And you can see the Robert Wise elements in it, the moody lighting. It's really moody compared to some of the other Star Treks, and also the story about relationships.
Though we're talking about him through the lens of horror, I do think him going into directing musicals is a natural progression of how he started out at RKO, because he started out as a sound editor, because they, if you didn't know, the R in RKO stands for radio. Mm-hmm. So he was a sound editor, so he understood how music worked, how sound worked, and then he turned into a film editor, which made him open to Orson Welles, and then he went into directing.
Yeah, I think another thing too is that he was able to, one of the few editors at the time that understood instinctively editing on beats, what people were talking about, because he was a sound editor. His film editing, if you watch his film editing, will hit certain beats, and he'll frame. And I know that he wasn't the only one in the room editing it, but when you see other films he's edited as well, that sound is definitely a component of his editing. So it makes sense, like you said, that he goes on and works in musicals. One of the reasons you said you picked this film was because of Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi were both in it.
Yes, but I wanted to discuss something a little bit different than Universal.
And the fact that this is like, what pairing is this? Is this towards the beginning of their pairing or towards the end?
This is actually their eighth and last pairing working together in films, actually just in general, because Bela Lugosi famously went off and did a bunch of Dracula tours, and he did the thing with Ed Wood, and then sadly died.
And his career is pretty much winding up at this point.
Yes. This is the beginning of the end for Bela Lugosi.
And this is where also Boris Karloff starts transitioning from being horror leading man. He starts doing a lot of, in the 60s, doesn't he do a lot of voiceover work?
He does do a lot of voiceover work, which is usually tied to his horror background. But he does actually star or co-star in a couple of like funny comedy movies. But yeah, they're all based, it's all based in the fact that he's a horror legend.
Yeah. Well, it's also like he was the narrator for How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the animated version. So Boris Karloff, that was not his real name, that's his stage name.
That's his stage name. His real name is William Henry Pratt, no relation to Chris Pratt that I know of. He
was born in England. A lot of people think he's American, but he was actually born in England.
He was born in England, and the reason there's a lot of speculation on why he changed his name, because you know how when actors change their name, they're always like, why? And it's always because somebody else had that name already or something. One school of thought is Boris Karloff changed his name because he didn't want to embarrass his family just in case he didn't make it.
Yeah.
And Boris, he has said in an interview, sounded like exotic. And then Karloff, people think maybe was his mom's maiden name, but there's no proof that that's actually like real, that okay. It's his mom's maiden name.
He was doing stage and vaudeville, right, before he started getting into film?
Yes, and he does do bit parts in films, too, until he's, like, the famous, you know.
Yeah, there's silent films and stuff like that you can see him in.
Well, there is an interview where he talks about when he goes back to England and his brothers are, like, really, like, excited, and this is that he's, like, cool and a cool film star, and this is before his famous debut as Frankenstein.
The monster in Frankenstein.
Frankenstein, yeah.
Okay, yeah. You know, I know that he's one of those guys that you just kind of think you know a lot about, and then you start reading and going, oh, wait, I don't know nearly enough about him, because he continued doing stage. Mm-hmm, in fact, he did Arsenic and Old Lace on stage.
Yes, which Bela Lugosi actually took over for him when he left Arsenic and Old Lace.
He also, he stayed active in both British cinema and American cinema, if I'm correct.
And also television. He has two stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, one for his work in film and one for his work in television.
Yeah, because in the 60s, he started seeing that the movies the movies that he normally would be in weren't being made as much, and television is where a lot of that kind of production went.
Because mm-hmm. there was definitely the switch in horror close in the 1950s, where it was no longer monster films. It was all about, like, alien invasions and nuclear apocalypse. Well, the monster films were definitely, we'll talk a little bit more about this later, wink, wink, were definitely a product of their time because they were in between two world wars. And as many yeah. horror fans know, the zeitgeist of society changes how horror is perceived. Because if we're, as a society, afraid of something, that will slowly turn into this wild beast character. And so they'll be like, you know, I'm afraid of nuclear war. Well, all our stories are going to be now about nuclear war.
Or somehow a metaphor for nuclear war.
Yeah, so there's definitely a switch between the 1920s and the 1970s, you can say. There's a lot of switches in between horror because of the fact that during this time, there's a lot of foreign policy happening.
So in the 50s, you have America coming out of World War II, becoming one of the main players on the international stage. The Cold War with Russia at this point really starts. You have both the Korean conflict and the Vietnam War and happening in our policy. So there's this big fear of communism taking over the world, which is why that's a metaphor for aliens attacking or nuclear war, which is why you sometimes get the monster movies like from Japan. Godzilla is created from nuclear war or nuclear issue. And so everything's tied into those fears.
And which, if somebody is famous for playing makeup monsters, that's what I like to call them when actors put on makeup and go raw. And that's no longer what audiences want to see. It does.
Well, in the flip side of that, though, because we do see Hammer Films in the 60s revitalize these films with Christopher Lee playing both two parts that Boris Karloff was famous for, both Frankenstein and Imhotep and the Mummy. And so it's really.
Christopher Lee also plays Dracula as well, actually more times than
Bela Lugosi. But Christopher Lee does these, but Hammer also updates them into the world of the 60s. So when you watch those films, they're very much also, they reinterpret them. And I think that's one thing, but what usually happens is there's this lull where, the like you said, the world, the zeitgeist changes. And so the film industry goes off in a different direction. And then eventually they come back and they go, oh, wait a minute, this monster can be or this character or this story can be reinterpreted this way. And they end up redoing it. The same reason why we're doing plays that are 400 years old still, because we can still reinterpret them and still redo them on stage and have a lot of fun watching them.
Mm-hmm. So how did Boris Karloff start out as a universal horror film mainstay to switching over to RKO?
So you have the studio system, and there's the studios that are considered the premier studios, like MGM, and then there are studios like RKO and Universal. They are constantly shifting what they're doing to keep up and being a successful studio. So that's why when Universal hits on the horror films and the Universal monsters of the 30s, it rides that for a while. And then Boris Karloff, you know, in 1945, he's been doing this for, you know, 15 years at that time. So it's kind of,
He's no longer playing Frankenstein.
No, he's, and they're offering him like bit parts and things like that. So he thinks it's time for it to end. At that point, Universal feels it's time for them to end
Frankenstein's monster. I'm sorry. I'm saying Frankenstein as the project, not Frankenstein as in his character.
Yeah. He's not being offered great roles. And he's also an actor's actor, so he understands that he's not going to be offered the leading part all the time. But he also thinks he has a lot more to offer. And so he decides to go and leave. And RKO at that point offers him this movie and one other movie. I forgot what it was.
He makes three movies with them in between 1945 and 1946.
Yeah.
Which includes this movie. And two others.
Yeah, I know. I completely just blanked on the movies. We'll put them in the
description down below.
Description notes down below. But anyway, he's offered these movies. He's like, okay, cool. I'm going to go over to RKO and have fun. And, you know, you get to work with an up-and-coming director like Robert Wise. And you get to go and do horror a little bit differently. He's able to, in this movie, he's not playing the monster like he usually is. No. I mean, he is the monster because he's the main bad guy, but he's not in makeup and playing like a makeup monster. He's playing a serial killer.
He's human. The monster is human.
And he gets to do a really kind of act. And I was really surprised by this movie when you brought it in, and like, I had never seen it. It was like, oh wow, I get to really watch Boris Karloff act, because you always kind of hear that he did this stuff on stage. But when he's in a Universal monster movie, it's kind of like, he's really kind of pigeonholed into a certain style of performing. And so I was like, oh wow, this is really good. And it was really kind of fun to see him really chew into some scenes. So,
yeah, I think one of the reasons, again, why I chose this film is because this was actually like the second or third movie that I watched him in.
Yeah.
And because the famous go-tos are, you know, Frankenstein and then Bride of Frankenstein, plus all the other
Frankenstein's. Isn't he even in the Abbott Costello Frankenstein, Meet Frankenstein?
No, but Bela Lugosi is.
Wait, he's not in the Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein?
No, because at that time he's not playing Frankenstein. It's someone junior.
Lon Chaney Jr.?
Young Chaney Jr. So they meet his Frankenstein. Bela Lugosi, though, because he was Igor in the third Frankenstein movie, he's in Meets Frankenstein. It's actually quite funny because I know we're talking a little bit about Universal, especially since this is an RKO thing, but it's very interesting to me how in the minds of the audience, when we say Universal movie monsters, we think of like the big six or the big five, because technically there's only five. Brightest Frankenstein isn't technically a real, you know, part of the pack.
Why?
I don't know. They came out, Universal came out a couple of decades ago, and they said, these are the five Universal monsters that are in, like, the Monster Squad. It's Frankenstein's monster, the creature.
Dracula.
Gill Man, which is the creature from the Black Lagoon, Wolf Man, Dracula, Invisible Man. Bride of Frankenstein is never mentioned. But she's always with the group. Yeah, to me it makes it laugh because you know how you have like that trope in movies where it's like five guys who are like who've been friends since high school and then that one guy's wife. That's kind of how it is.
Okay, yeah, I get it. No, it's funny because it's like I never really thought about that because I always thought of her as part of the...
Because she's always with it. To be honest, she always knocks out either the Invisible Man or the Wolf Man.
Yeah. Because when you see the pictures and stuff, she's always there and one of them may not be. I think it was part of the group more than the Invisible Man, although the Invisible Man is a really good...
Well, to be honest, if we were going to kick out anybody in the group, it should be Gillman because he's like 20 years after most of those characters' times. He comes up around 1950s, 1960s.
Although he's such an iconic monster. But it's really funny. Universal gets away from their monster movies and then they go back to them. They keep trying to like...
Well, it's undeniable that the monster movies are part of Universal's DNA, depending on how they want to create new stuff with that. And we can debate it later when I'm, you know, because if I mention Tom Cruise's Mummy, I'm going to talk 5 years about it. But undeniably, that is part of their DNA. And what we want from Universal is monster movies. There's something iconic about the 1930s and the 1940s when it comes to monster films or just comes to horror films in general because of the fact that it's a little bit more tighter storytelling. And it's also the first time that horror films actually talked about certain issues.
Yeah, people used horror, like they would later use science fiction to talk about issues. And they still do that. They still use horror films to talk about.
The most famous example is Get Out, you know? Yeah.
And so it's like they still, you can do a lot inside of a horror structure to would discuss things and like science fiction and, you know, even adventure movies, you know, like you'll see like adventure movies where they'll mix in a different, you know, commentaries on society. Because you're in this middle of this adventure film or this horror film or a science fiction film, they're not beating you over the head with what's going on in society. But like I said, that's what makes horror films great in the 50s is because people are really worried about the nuclear war, communism, the rise of communism around the world. And so when you watch these alien invasion films and things like that. That's what they're talking about is people's fear. So one of the things that I really enjoyed about this film is the fact, like we kind of touched on a little bit earlier about the moodiness, this gothic horror element to it. And I really enjoy when films really have a look, a feel all the way through it. And this film really does have a really tight gothic, darkly lit, gaslight type look. I mean, that's the period it takes place in, and they really work really well trying to make it. Because sometimes you'll watch a film made in that era, 1945. It's supposed to be 1820s in, London or something, and it's like the most well lit house, and the most. It's like, oh my god, I didn't know they had lighting like that. So it's like So they did a really good job of using the gaslight to really set the mood.
I think it also is that lighting, and I'm not trying to take away the amazingness direction from Robert Wise, but I think it also attests to the fact that Val Lewton worked with a lot of German expressionist directors, and you can definitely see the German expression horror elements seep through the cracks in this movie.
Yeah, and that's a lot of people tend to forget that that's what kind of led to film noir in the first place was the directors that were leaving Germany because in 1933 Hitler comes to power and a lot of the directors are like, I'm out, I'm Jewish and I'm liberal, so he's coming after me.
And the people who didn't leave usually did Nazi propaganda.
Yeah. And so they left and they went to both England and America, and you start seeing their, we talked about this last year with Billy Wilder, and they bring that more dark and expressionistic type of filming. And that leads really into film noir, because that kind of, and then you get films like that aren't film noir that are filmed that way, like Citizen Kane and this film, where, and it gives them a real sense of place. And they use the light, the lighting to help tell the story just as much as the black spaces. And they really use that contrast to really frame things and move, and the camera placement, and it, and this film, you really, like I said, you felt like you were in, you know, the gaslight era of England, where everything was lit by these, by gas, and very little lights in certain places. And it was great. It was great lighting.
It was great lighting. And I think a lot of people, when they focus on cinematography and they focus on light direction, they always focus on picture color, color pictures. And I think,
well, if you start studying cinematography, you'll go back to black and white, because
yes, but when people usually start a conversation, they usually start a conversation with, when it comes to color film. And the thing is, granted, there's, in the history of movies, there's a lot more colored movies now than there was back then.
Well, they didn't have color.
Well, yeah, but
well, no, they had since the beginning of filming, they had had different attempts to color. Like even Intolerance, which we talked about with a couple weeks ago, they tinted the film, so it would come, so it would show blue during a scene, or yellow during a scene, or red during a scene, to kind of tell you what to feel in that scene. And they came up with what was called a two-color process, which was really good. You could see reds and blues fairly well, but you couldn't see other colors. So it was spotty. And then it was, but also super expensive. And then when they finally came out with the color film, it was super slow, meaning you had to shine a lot of light on it. And so that's why you see a lot of the first color films being really stagey, just like you see a lot of the first sound films being really stagey, because they didn't have directional mics. They didn't have, they did all that kind of stuff.
Also, totally forgot to mention RKO on Pioneer Sound movies.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, and they did. And but the films became very stagey because they couldn't move the camera around, because the camera made noise and they didn't have a way of filtering that noise out. And their mics were, they were omnidirectional. So they basically picked up the sound from everywhere.
You can see definitely the transition between how the camera moves when sound happens with Charlie Chaplin's filmography, because with when he comes with the Tramp movies, there's a lot of fluidity, a lot of movement. The camera moves with the Tramp, or Charlie Chaplin's character. And when he does The Great Dictator, a lot of that film is just stagnant.
Which is stagey. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why he resisted so long to making a sound film.
That, and also he had a lot of fans throughout the world, and the minute you put a language into a film, is the minute you cut off
a lot of fun. Yeah, and that is actually a problem. But on the flip side of that, because sound started taking over, and English was what was being done out of Hollywood, you ended up with a lot of countries that had okay film production really starting to do their own film production and do their own. And then that, now you look at now, there's a huge, rich film community around the world doing different types of films. Yeah. So getting back to the way that the film looked, and sorry, we went off on that tangent there.
I think it's a good tangent.
No, but this is the type of horror film. When I say there's certain horror films I like, it's this type of horror film, where it's more atmospheric. It still plays with your mind a little bit. This one doesn't have the shock horror. You know, there's no jump scares or anything like
except
that,
for that one scene with the horse. I was totally that.
Oh yeah,
he comes around the corner. Boris Karloff. He's a cab driver, and during, you know, the 1800s, they didn't have cars, so they have horse drawn cabs. And so he has a horse throughout this whole thing. I don't know what it was, but he turns around the corner to say, like, hello and to his horse. And I don't know, maybe it was the music. Maybe it was, I just blinked for a second. But I was like, oh, my God. Ah! I've seen this movie before, and it scared me. It was so funny.
Yeah, I know. I don't think that, like you were saying, you don't think that most movies from this period would be considered scary now?
No, definitely. But there's also this other... Because what we're used to is either someone stabbing you in the leg or...
Why the leg?
I don't know. I thought that was the least explicit thing. I don't know. But like people stabbing, it's either like...
Stabbing.
Ah, stab. Or getting chased or...
Like Halloween.
Halloween. Yeah, Halloween, It Follows. Things like that where it's like there's constant action and constant violence on state in the frame. I think this.
Do you think that's why some of the like Japanese and Asian horror have become so popular in America? Because they kind of go back to this tradition of atmosphere and subtle horror. And I mean, some of them are really scary.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say they did it or not, but do you think that that's why some people like them? Because they're not nearly as gory or it's a more of a psychological scare versus an action scare?
I think that could be a possibility because the couple of the big named, you know, Japanese and Chinese horror films that come to America, have a big following and then eventually get, you know, Hollywoodized.
Remade.
Are usually like there is a person or a creature chasing them, but it's not like they can see it, mm-hmm. You know, because you're like, okay, I know I'm going to get attacked, but when am I going to get attacked? And I think that definitely that, because there's this whole thing where it's like the anticipation scares you more than the needle prick when it comes to like
getting shots.
And I think that's the same thing with horror, where it's like the anticipation of the horror gets you more than the stab.
Yeah. You know? Well, that's ironically for somebody who watches violent films, I don't like the super violent horror films.
And you can't deny that this horror film is not a violent horror film.
No, he kills like three or four people in this film.
Including a dog.
Yeah. And it's also done in that very film noir in the shadows. And there's you see certain things in the light and see certain things not. So your imagination is filling in the blanks.
Well, there's also during this time, the Hays Code.
Yeah.
Which is if you're a history movie fan.
You know what's going on. Between the 30s and the 60s, the Hays Code is pretty much regulating and censoring films, and nothing immoral can be on what they deem immoral.
Yeah.
Which ironically always gets me because it's like there's always something in a movie like where I'm going, that was okay, but.
Yeah, you can be full out racist, but you can't. But it actually, because this movie is in their eyes and during this time was violent, it was condemned by the city of Chicago, the state of Ohio, and got a B rating from the National Legion of Decency because of their excessive gruesomeness.
Well, I mean, I think the thing, because Robert Louis Stevenson based his story. So people who don't know, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote a bunch of adventure books, but he also wrote a couple horror books like Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, this short story. So he's we would consider nowadays a pulp writer or a popular writer.
This short story actually showed up in a magazine.
Yeah. And so he based this on a real life instance, Burke and Hare.
That he actually lived through because he published this almost like, I think it was like 5 to 10 years after.
Yeah. And he, in Burke and Hare in Edinburgh, Scotland, they basically were grave robbers who robbed the graves of recently deceased people and sold them to doctors so they could do their medical schools and train their up and coming doctors on anatomy and things like that. Cause there was no way of getting bodies for this. So this was a common thing. Well, they started running out of bodies to get. They also started, you know, posting guards on graveyards. One of the reasons why we have there's that whole motif of the graveyard watchman at night is for this, for grave robberies.
And if you've ever been to England or if you go to Scotland or some other places like Italy as well, because this was really popular in Italy, and you go into a graveyard and there's a lot of Victorian era graves, you will see like cages on the graves. And this was a practice due to the fact that people were stealing bodies.
Yeah. So when Burke and Hare couldn't get bodies, they killed people. Now, some people say they started off by killing people who were near death, and so they just like hurried the process along. But the fact of the matter is they became serial killers, murderers, and they would then give these bodies to there's two competing doctors.
But the famous one is Knox.
Knox.
Which is an important name for you to remember if you do decide to go watch this movie, because
it's referenced. Mm-hmm. And, well, the thing, too, that's really kind of important about Burke and Hare is it's another one of those cases where Burke and Hare did the killings and they brought the bodies to the doctor. When everything fell apart, Burke and Hare were tried and executed.
One of them was.
And the other one went to jail.
And then got released and now lives somewhere because he's never been seen again. Well, he's probably not living.
Because it's 100 years later. But Dr. Knox pretty much got to walk away. And so it was in one of those cases that was viewed as if you were rich and had social standing, you weren't punished. And if you were poor and scraping by, you bore the brunt of the issues. Now, granted, those two actually did the killing, but he was an accessory to the fact because it was proven that he did know how they got the bodies.
Yes. This practice, by the way, is called body snatching, not the murdering, but the grave robbing.
And that's where the title of the movie comes from.
And so what you see throughout this movie is this class on anatomy, which is like partly trying to figure out how the body works, partly like intro to surgery. That's one of the reasons why they need these cadavers. And why Edinburgh, Scotland is the center of this story, plus also the center of Hare and Burke's story, is because this was one of three places where the radical idea of surgery in the medical profession started to pick up. And I did mention earlier, with the cages, Italy was one of those other places.
Well, it's also,
and then another place in Netherlands.
Well, yeah, and yet the radical idea of this for surgery wasn't like surgery had never been done before. The radical idea was actually studying the human body, so you knew what you were doing.
Yes, and which is why they needed the cadavers, because
though
we just talked about people murdering people for the cadavers, it is more ethical to perform a surgery for the first time on a cadaver in their minds than on a human being.
The students would understand what they were doing. They knew how the body parts all work together and the muscles. So you can look, because you could look at a skeleton and imagine how the muscles were supposed to be on there and stuff like that. But this is the first time where they really started thinking, maybe we should know where everything's attached and understand the human body before we start hacking away on it and trying to heal it. And so that was the radical idea.
And of course, a lot of people at the time when I was reading articles based on Burke and Hare, a lot of people said that they brought body snatching to its natural conclusion. You know, when you're getting money for everybody and you no longer have bodies, you're going to kill people for money. And that's kind of,
it was good
of,
money too. That a lot of people don't realize that. It was like
£7, which when we think about that today, we think of it as our pounds, but it's actually a lot more.
Yeah. People were making like £2 a year.
Yeah.
So think about that.
Do you like serial killer films?
It depends. Again, it goes into that whole thing about I like the puzzle piece parts of serial killer films or like TV shows. Like there's certain TV shows where you're Britain has a couple. I used to like Prime Suspect and I've liked different shows like that throughout time where you're like, you see them trying to track that person down and it becomes like this cat and mouse game. And, It's a lot more psychological. I don't like serial killer films if they're just serial killing, like you're just following a serial killer going through the numbers, and then eventually they make a mistake and the cops catch them. It's kind of like they're just showing you the gruesome part of serial killing, and there are a fair amount of those out there. And so I like it more when it's psychological and you're trying to do it. Like the series I'm going to start next after Christmas is I'm going to go back and watch The Fall with Gillian Anderson, and because that's another one of those stories. And but it's just like it's on my list, my queue. And so it's just one of those things where I think serial killer films have become more defined over time. Like people, when this movie came out, the term serial killer wasn't even around.
No. It wasn't defined until the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, in the 70s is when they actually like said there are people who are serial killers, and that has to do with, and then, you know, there's people making rumblings in the 60s like, hey, these people, some of these people are, like Jack the Ripper, which is one of the most famous serial killers out there, was never defined in his time as a serial killer. And so I think that's what was really kind of important about these films, is that we today look back on those films or those stories or those real happenings. Right? I mean, that's a serial killer that did that. They weren't even defined that way back then. And that they were defined, and they were defined as monsters, and because people didn't have a definition for them.
No, yeah.
And so, yes, I do like, do you like serial killer films?
I do like serial killer films in the similar way that you do, in the sense that I like the mystery, but I don't like it when people are like, stab, 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 stab. And you're like, whoa, too much.
Do you think this film holds up?
It's a very interesting, actually, that's a very interesting question. To me, the movie holds up, but maybe to somebody else who also enjoys horror, the movie, again, isn't scary or doesn't.
Could be considered slow.
It can be considered slow because of the fact that it doesn't show what we're used to, especially in this day and age. And one thing about horror that I really enjoy is that there's so much subcategories and different tropes and things like that. So you can really pick and choose your a la carte, you know, a la carte menu of what horror is. So to me, this movie does hold up, but to somebody else, it might not.
I thought the filmmaking aspects of it were so sound that it does hold up. The way, like you said, the way the sound, the way it was shot, the way it was acted, the fact that it was a very tight film at 78 minutes, wasn't super long. Didn't overstay its welcome. It had a main story that it followed, although there was a couple other side story, subplots and things like that that were in the film. It didn't take over the film. And it was fun to see Boris Karloff being somebody other than a monster, makeup monster. And so, and kind of being a bad person, but like getting to be the bad person on screen.
To be completely honest, Boris Karloff's performance creeps me out.
Yeah, well, yeah, he's supposed to.
He's supposed to, but it's like more creepy than anything that he's ever done, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think it really does hold up, and I think it does a really good job of being a good example of like a B horror film from that time, that what you could do with B horror films, because there's a lot of B horror films that are now considered classics, and there's a lot that have been forgotten, rightfully so, because they weren't very good. No. But you see a lot of, some of these B-horror films, these directors who were given kind of free range, they have fun with it.
Actually, Val Lewton actually thought that this could be an A movie.
Because you're making a B-movie doesn't mean you walk in there saying, I'm making a B-movie. Well, there were probably directors who did that, and writers and actors, which is probably why those are the ones that aren't remembered.
Yes.
And then there are directors and actors and writers who go into a B-movie and understand that they're given incredible freedom at this point, because it's, they're not being so watched by the studio at this point. They just want to make sure the film comes out on budget and is the story that they're paying for. Mm-hmm. And you see Robert Wise really stretching his wings as a director and experimenting a little bit. And there is some tonal shifts that are a little clunky, but that's okay. I mean, it's your first major film that you're directing that I think people who are fans of this era of horror will probably really enjoy.
Or like film noirs as well. Well, we hope you enjoyed this conversation with The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema, about The Body Snatcher. If you did enjoy us and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. If you want to follow us on Instagram, you can at TML, A Journey Through Cinema. We are on Twitter at TML, A Journey. We're on Facebook under The Movie Log 1. You can find all our past episodes on our website, which is www.tmlajourneythroughcinema.com. Next week, we can continue our dive into our Halloween movie month with a Korean horror sci-fi film.
Have a great day.
Have a great day. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.